855-2266 or Nature's Way Incorporated in Effingham, 800-369-1247. Support for today's broadcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 15 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, chocolates, cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is hour number two of the program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour of the show, we'll be having another visit with author and cartoon historian Bob Harvey. He has been a magazine cartoonist himself. He's also published in comic strip, editorial cartoon, and the comic book genres. He has authored a number of books, including The Art of the Funnies and The Art of the Comic Book. He has a website, rcharvey.com, where there's a lot of information about what is happening in the world of comic art. He is also the author of a new biography that we'll be spending some time talking about this morning, a biography of Milt Caniff, the man who created the comic strips Steve Canyon and Terry and the Pirates, and who is, within the history of cartooning, certainly a very important figure in and of himself, and also important for having inspired and mentored a lot of other comic artists as well. The book has just recently been published, and he, in fact, will be doing a signing at Pages for All Ages Bookstore this weekend, Saturday at 2 o'clock, and he'll be doing a short talk before. So if you're interested in comic art, you might want to stop by, and you can certainly take a look at the book. We'll talk a little bit about that this morning and other questions about comic art, whether we're talking about comic books or newspaper comic strips or graphic novels. Any of that is certainly welcome, because I know that Bob spends a lot of time keeping up with developments in this area. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So if you have a question, you are certainly welcome to call. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's good to be back.
You know, something that I thought I didn't mention this before, but something I thought I might ask you to do is to talk a little bit about Doug Marlette.
Okay.
The artist, he was an editorial cartoonist and also did a comic strip, a regular strip. And sadly enough, he just passed away just last week.
Yes, he was a passenger in a pickup truck, wouldn't you know? I mean, he grew up in North Carolina, and his comic strip is about a teenager growing up in the South in the world of pickup trucks. And wouldn't you know, Doug Marlette would be a passenger in a pickup truck. A friend was taking him from the Memphis airport to Oxford, Mississippi, to witness a high school production of a musical that he co-wrote based on the comic strip Kudzu, his comic strip. And it had been raining, and they skidded off the rain-slick highway and hit a tree, and that was the end. The driver survived and apparently was not seriously hurt. Yeah. But Marlette was probably killed instantly. He started cartooning as an editorial cartoonist almost the minute he graduated from college. He graduated in 1972, if I remember this right, and started working for the Charlotte Observer as an editorial cartoonist. And then in 1981, he had the idea for the comic strip Kudzu. Kudzu is the name of a pernicious weed, as Marlette described it, which was imported into the South during the Depression as a way of stopping erosion. Well, kudzu pretty soon took over the entire South, and it grew, as Marlette said, it would grow a foot a day. There, you couldn't kill it. It grew up. It covered barns and bridges and highways and slow-moving children. It would just take everything over. And I've said, you know, that probably kudzu is a greater threat to the American society than terrorists. I mean, it will probably take everything over given enough time. And he named his comic strip and the teenage hero of that because teenagers grow fast like kudzu. But the character that he invented in this comic strip that was the most popular was a televangelist preacher named will be done, who is about as grasping and self-centered and as you could imagine. It was a blatant satire on the Jerry Falwells of the world. And, of course, the strip appeared right about the time that the moral majority assumed political significance in the early 80s with the coming of the Reagan administration. And surprisingly, as I said, even in the South, Will Be Done was the favorite character of many people. He virtually took over the comic strip. Mm-hmm. One of the reprints of strips featuring Will Be Done is called There's No Business Like Soul Business. But he was also, Marlette was also a fierce editorial cartoonist. He was surprisingly, again, a social liberal, even if he was a fiscal conservative. But a social liberal coming from the South was an unusual manifestation. And he worked for several other papers. He went from the Charlotte Observer to the Atlantic Constitution and then to Newsday and then to the Tallahassee Democrat, I believe is the name of it. But he, for the Tallahassee Democrat, he went back to his hometown, Hillsboro, North Carolina, and he cartooned by email. And then he got a job with the Tulsa World, which is where he was working at the time he was killed. He's also written two novels, both of which have serious autobiographical elements in them. The first one is called The Bridge, and the other one is called The Magic, I don't know, The Magic Fair, something. It just came out this year. The Bridge came out about 2-3 years ago. Hmm. Very talented guy. And highly regarded as a professional editorial cartoonist.
That suggests an opportunity just also to talk about something else a little bit that we have talked about before, and that is the vanishing editorial cartoonist. I was really struck. I read a couple of things about the fact that here this fairly recently, I think also maybe within about the last week or 10 days, there was the meeting of the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists.
Yes.
They have their own group. And in fact, it was the 50th anniversary of the founding of the
right.
group.
Right.
And one of the things that they spent a lot of time talking about was the decline in the number of cartoonists, at least the number of cartoonists that are employed by papers. And one of the stories that I read about it, there was a quote here that says that if you compare today to 1957, there is roughly a quarter of the staff positions that they were at that time. So, mm-hmm. so 3/4 of the editorial cartoonists that were regularly employed on staff by newspapers are gone.
Right. Well, that's they say, incidentally, I'm a member of that group, and I was at that convention that you're talking about.
Okay.
And
mm-hmm.
one of the big topics, of course, was what are we going to do about this?
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't anything you can do about it. Newspapers are the home of the editorial cartoonist, and newspapers are in difficulty. That is, they're in difficulty with Wall Street. They're not actually in difficulty. Newspapers have generally run a profit margin of 20-25%. Which is greater than any other industry in the country. But that's a steady income, and Wall Street investors like increasing income. So the only way to get increasing income for a newspaper is to reduce its operating expense. Newspapers are declining in circulation, and their advertising revenue is declining. So there's not much hope that they're going to increase the profit margin by increasing their income. But they can improve the bottom line by eliminating the expenses. And one of the most obvious places to begin is with an editorial, with a staff editorial cartoonist, because they can get syndicated editorial cartoonists like the News Gazette does to dress up their editorial page. And that's what's been happening. There are major newspapers. For example, the Chicago Tribune has not had an in-house staff editorial cartoonist since the death of Jeff McNally in 2000. Which is a long time. They keep saying they're still looking for somebody, but I'm convinced that that is a posture that they assume in order to quiet the multitudes, that they really are quite happy using syndicated material. A lot of the editorial cartoonists have turned to the internet and are doing animated editorial cartoons on the internet. pretty much if you're going to go to the internet, you're going to have to be animating. Otherwise, there's probably not much reason to look at it. The newspaper business, however, I think is going to come back into its own before the editorial cartoonists are ever going to decide what they could do instead. And once the newspapers start coming back, they will start hiring editorial cartoonists again. I wrote a piece about this one time. Actually, I just finished writing it for my website. It's not been posted yet, but the point of an article written in 1957, which prompted the formation of this group 50 years ago, was that the quality of American editorial cartooning was in decline. And the person who wrote this article, who was a college professor of journalism, recalled a turn of the century, that is 1900, when we had 3,000 daily newspapers and almost all of them had an editorial cartoon on the front page. Why? Well, that's how you created excitement. You got people angry. You got them excited to buy newspapers, find out what the heck's going on here. And the whole point was to be opinionated and to stir up the multitudes. Well, no newspaper editor today wants to stir anybody up because stirred up people might stop buying the paper. And most newspapers are subscription circulated now. They're not newsstand sales like they used to be. So, and most of them are the only newspaper in town. They're not competing with another paper. Editors and publishers tend to want things to be quiet. And the thing that will upset a newspaper reader almost as much as getting as the paper publishing the crossword incorrectly or dropping a comic strip from the comic strip lineup is an editorial cartoonist drawing something nasty about a local politician or a local government. That's where the real power in editorial cartooning lies. It's also the thing that immediately starts readers phoning the paper and distracting editors from their normal work. So they're not really fond of editorial cartooning on local issues, which plays right into the syndicated business because syndicated cartoons are never about local issues. They're always about national issues.
Yeah.
If you draw a cartoon about the mayor in Champaign or Urbana, you're going to get a nasty cartoon. You'll get a phone call from the mayor's office, but you can draw all the nasty cartoons about Bush that you want. You'll never get a phone call from the White House. Pretty much.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, that's interesting, guys. I can certainly imagine a lot of editors saying, well, why should I have a staff editorial cartoonist when I can buy my cartoons? After all, what we have on the comic page, they're not drawn here. We buy them from a syndicate,
right,
too.
Right.
I might not buy all my cartoons from a syndicate. It's a lot more cost-effective that way.
Oh, of course it is. And not only that, you usually get a package, so you have a selection every day of cartoons. If you have a staff cartoonist, you have to do what he does, or you have to choose from one or two roughs that he provides you with. But a staff cartoonist gives your paper a connection to the community that a syndicated cartoonist never has.
Mm-hmm.
And most staff cartoonists are personalities in the communities that they work in, staff editorial cartoonists. Nobody in all of this business, the danger to editorial cartooning as a profession arises entirely from these financial considerations. It doesn't come from the absence of quality in their work. In fact, the quality, the power, and the artistry of editorial cartooning today is much better than it ever has been. The power of editorial cartooning, the biggest, most compelling testimony to that is what happened in the wake of 9/11. Editorial cartoonists, of course, drew on Tuesday and Wednesday of that terrible occasion, editorial cartoons about it. And most papers were flooded immediately by requests from readers wanting prints of those cartoons. And newspapers customarily printed them off and sold them for $10 a piece and took the money and gave it to charity funds being raised for the victims. But to my knowledge, no newspaper was ever flooded with requests for prints of photographs of 9/11 that they published.
Yeah.
But the editorial cartoons were extremely popular.
Yeah, I suppose that the cartoonist has the advantage of operating on a very short timeline, so
yeah,
it's possible to respond to some current event much more quickly than maybe other kinds of artists or journalists or writers.
Yeah, and if you're on staff, you can even turn around completely. The famous story, one of the most famous editorial cartoons in recent years is Bill Mauldin's drawing that he produced the day of Kennedy's assassination. He drew a picture of the statue of Lincoln in the Lincoln Memorial. Lincoln was bent forward with his head in his hands. No words. It was drawn in 45 minutes on Friday afternoon. Malden was at a lunch that day, and the luncheon speaker never showed up or never made his speech because they heard about the Kennedy assassination. And Malden, who had already drawn his cartoon for that day's paper, went back to the office grief-stricken about this and drew that cartoon in 45 minutes. It was printed full-size on the back page of the Sun-Times, and most news dealers displayed that cartoon at their newsstand. They didn't display the front page.
Yeah, that's. I think it's interesting to think about cartoons as something that can, in a very rapid, flexible way, reflect popular culture. I'm thinking now just in fact about the mood after 9/11, and I'm reminded particularly of one cartoon that appeared in New Yorker. It was cartoony. It was set in a bar, and here's a man and a woman sitting there, and the guy is wearing just the most horrible sport coat you ever saw. And the caption is, the woman says to him, "You know, I never thought I'd laugh again, and then I saw your jacket."
Yes, that was the turnaround cartoon. I think it appeared the week in the issue after 9/11, not the first issue, but the next issue. And of course, the big concern at the New Yorker and everywhere, David Letterman and so on, was when can we start laughing again? And that was a perfect cartoon, absolutely perfect for the occasion. Can't remember who did it. It was either Shannon or Leo Cullum, one of those two. And I can't.
I know that the card is. I know his work when I see it.
Yeah.
But I it was one of those where I could not tell you. Some of the cartoonists in the New Yorker, I can actually. I know who they are. people like Bob Mankoff and Roz Chast. But that particular one, I don't. But I certainly do remember the cartoon. Well, we have somebody here who would like to talk. Why don't we do that? Let me also very quickly just say again, our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is author, cartoon historian Bob Harvey. Has written a number of books about the aesthetics of cartoons, comic strip, including The Art of the Funnies and The Art of the Comic Book. And he has a new book out that we will talk about, I promise. It is a biography of the artist Milt Caniff, the man who created the comic strips Terry and the Pirates and Steve Canyon. And he will be doing, that is, Bob will be doing a book signing of this book coming up this weekend, Saturday, 2 in the afternoon at Pages for All Ages. We have a caller here, someone to talk with in Champaign. That's line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just calling for verification. I've been listening to the program, and I heard something about that there's going to be a turnaround or something around newspapers. Did I hear correctly or what?
That's my prediction. I don't think it's written anywhere. I mean, I don't.
Okay. Well, I would love for it to happen.
Yeah, I think what's going to happen is, of course, the newspaper people, by which I mean journalists, are perfectly conscious of their medium haven't been taken over by Wall Street investors. And there are now various newspapers that are being purchased by consortiums of billionaires who are not Wall Street investors and who are interested in putting the daily journalism back in the hands of journalists. I'm trying to think. I think one of the Philadelphia newspapers has been purchased by one of them, and maybe the Chicago Tribune. There's been a good deal of conversation along those lines. And I'm what I'm doing when I said that was predicting a turnaround rather than based on these instances that I referred to. But it's not anything that is frozen in marble or anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll record the time and the date of this, and you know, keep referring back to you. no, I would. It would be very sad that, and as you mentioned, my background was business and marketing stuff, and I mean, such high margins. I mean, my goodness. I mean, and in the newspaper industry, and for Wall Street, and that's what it is. They want the greed, the more money. So anyway,
yeah.
Good show.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. And certainly other questions, comments related to comics and comics art are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455.
You know, when we were talking about editorial cartoons and the impact that they have on readers, the way that they engage, and of course leads me to leap right into Milton Caniff, whose great connection with readership occurred in the during World War II, when he sent his character, Terry, and the lead character in Terry and the Pirates, into what was then called the Air Corps, which became the Air Force. And the intensity with which readers watched Terry and the Pirates, the adventures of this fictional character on the comics pages, there were wives who clipped the strip regularly and sent it to their husbands who were in the service overseas, and husbands who posted these on the company bulletin boards of the units that they were serving in, so that people could keep up to date. It wasn't just Terry and the Pirates that was so passionately followed by newspaper readers. All comic strips had had a devoted readership in the 20s and 30s and through the 40s. That is, to imagine what it is like, you have to imagine every newspaper reader is like a fan, like a dedicated fan of Seinfeld or The Friends or something. Television has given us now that kind of viewer or audience engagement that comic strips used to have in newspapers. And so it wasn't just Terry and the Pirates. But Kniff, because he attempted to produce a realistic story, the characters had to be real, the pictures that he drew had to be pictures of actual things, not imagined things. If he drew a character holding a pistol, it looked like a pistol. It didn't look like a blob. And he would get criticisms or letters from readers. And during World War II, it was from servicemen who would say, well, you have the chaplain's collar device on upside down. Or, you know, that extent of detailed observation by people who were dedicated readers of this strip. And because he was so in touch with the lives of servicemen serving on the line, so to speak, he enjoyed an enormous readership during that time, and became one of the most well-known comic strip artists, cartoonists in the country at the time because of that. He was also a personable and gifted public persona. He had a way of presenting himself and his profession that brought dignity to both. On a personal level, he could make you feel at ease in an instant. You never felt. The first time I met him, he said something to me that immediately put me at ease. It was maybe something like, good to see you. Something that was completely ordinary and mundane, but it made you feel that, well, you know, I'm meeting an old friend here. This isn't my first encounter with this person. It's like we've got back together after a long absence or something like that. And he had a gift to do that. And everybody who ever met him speaks of exactly this thing.
We have another call here to talk with. Why don't we do that? This is someone in Lovington on cell phone, line one. Hello.
Hi, I'll make my ask my question and hang up after I'm done, wait for comment. I guess this is more of an editorial question or comment. I've noticed that even the written editorials are generally national now, and I just you made the comment that if you write a cartoon that's critical of someone locally, you'll get a bunch of phone calls. And I've noticed that that seems to be happening a lot locally, that, you know, somebody will give a reporter a hard time for writing the truth as they saw it. And I just wondered if that is a recent phenomenon or that's always gone on, that people hassle their reporters in the newspaper directly for what they said. Thanks.
Well, I think that's probably always been true, probably more so 50 years ago than now, simply because people were more engaged as readers of newspapers than they now are. The average age of newspaper readers, newspaper subscribers, has been steadily increasing over the years as, neither of my children, who are in their 30s now, subscribes to a daily newspaper. And that describes a whole lot of people in that generation. But 50, 60, 70 years ago, newspapers were one of the principal sources of news, information, and entertainment. And you go back to the 1920s, before radio was national and before anybody had even heard of television, newspapers were the only thing that came into the house that bore information and entertainment. So readers were much more engaged than let me put it this way, that the engagement of an audience was more widespread than it is now. And readers tended to pick on just tiny things. If you read letters to the editors in newspapers in the 30s, you'll find them talking about really minuscule matters that they object to in either a news story or a comic strip or something. So that it's not a new phenomenon. I suspect that the kinds of objections that are being made now are somewhat more sophisticated, and probably the editing that results in the selection of the new letters to the editor that are being printed is also a little bit more selective than it used to be.
Mm. All right. Questions are welcome. We're talking this morning with author, comic historian Bob Harvey. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Kniff, he seemed to be somebody who liked to draw starting from a very young age, and people seemed to think that he had talent, and he continued to draw all the way. He drew in high school and in college before he went and did that for a living. So it seemed like this was a guy who was born to be an artist of some kind. And I'm really impressed in the book that you have some examples of not only his cartooning and how that style evolved over time, but some of the little bit of the commercial artwork that he did. And he also, not only was he a very accomplished cartoonist, he also was very good with caricature, and he was a very good portrait artist.
Yes, yeah.
You could really see that this man really could draw and could work in various kinds of styles equally well.
Yeah. He went to college at Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio, and worked his way through college on the Columbus Dispatch. And his drawing assignments were varied and many, and he worked from late in the afternoon until the wee hours of the morning. He also managed to work in career in the local theater. Sometimes he would work till 7 o'clock, and then he'd have a piece in a local play across the street, and he'd go over there and do his piece, come back at 10 o'clock and finish. But the kinds of work he was doing were ordinary cartoon work, and then portraits of local dignitaries, of theatrical personalities who back in the 20s and early 30s were traveling around the country a good bit. And there was a theater in Columbus that was part of a roadshow itinerary. So he saw a lot of that. When he first left Columbus and went to New York, he went to work for Associated Press. And one of his first jobs was drawing all of the presidential candidates, potential presidential candidates, in the spring of 1932. And there were 18 of them, or some huge number like that. And he drew pen and ink and pebble board, which permits you to add a gray tone by using a crayon to shade the drawing. And that's what he did. And he always joked that the two drawings that he made that he was least happy with were Hoover and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who ended up being the final candidates. And the pictures were used all over the country because they were circulated by the Associated Press to every place. But he was an accomplished artist. And you didn't say this, David, but your next sentence could have been, as opposed to many of today's cartoonists who are not accomplished artists.
Yes.
I have to agree. That's true. There are very few artists of the caliber of Kniff working in newspapers today. The fellow that draws Gary Gianni, that draws Prince Valiant, is of that caliber. There are very few of the serious storytelling strips of the kind that Kniff did, and almost none of the adventure genre, which he became so adept at. What he did, one of his signal accomplishments as a cartoonist in the history of the medium, was to show how you could take the old adventure strip formula of a hero coming in and doing wonderful deeds and rescuing the damsel in distress and so on, how you could enhance the suspense and the sense of enjoyment that a reader would experience by introducing character development into this aged formula. So you, as a reader, were not concerned not only with what was going to happen, but how the characters were going to change, or if they would change. Would they improve? Would they get worse? And this was something that nobody was doing before Kniff did it. He's often credited in the cartooning fraternity with developing a style of drawing called chiaroscuro, in which you suggest shapes and you do your modeling of shapes and so on with black shadow rather than by drawing every wrinkle in the suit, in the clothing, for example. But his and he did that. I mean, there's no question that his use of that technique was widely imitated. But his real skill, his great talent, was in storytelling, and that is inimitable. People don't – you either have the gift or you don't, and he had the gift.
Hmm. Well, let's talk with someone else. We have a caller in Joliet, line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I had just two quick things. You were talking about editorial cartoons, and my favorite was – it was either the first or second election of Bush with Dan Quayle. And the issue of his draft dodging came up, Dan Quayle. They took that picture of Nick Ute. You'll remember this one, the girl whose back was filled with napalm, and her back is burning, and she's running towards the camera naked over in Vietnam, and her village is in flames in the background. And he cartooned that, and then he has Quayle off on frame left with his bag of golf clubs and his question, mind if I play through?
Yeah, right.
Which was, to me, I mean, I can remember that was 10, 12 years ago, whatever it was.
But, well, there was a powerful use of a horrifying image to castigate the apparently trivial attention span of Vice President Quayle.
Yeah, well, the one comment that I remember, I think it was a cartoonist at the Tribune, said, this is the worst violation of an editorial cartoonist sense of propriety, and then he paused and he says, however, it was the most brilliant thing I've ever seen.
Yes, right.
The question I have for you is, I'm 60 now, and so I've long since stopped reading cartoons, only because of lack of interest, but when I was a kid, it seemed like there was a number of cartoons that featured the idea of a secret identity, like the Phantom, for example, not Superman, in which it was always at the cusp, you know, at the edge of being revealed. And for some reason, for myself and many of my friends, and obviously nationwide, it seemed to hold this fascination that suddenly this person's real identity would be revealed. Do you have any thoughts about that? I don't see that anymore. I don't see that type of thing.
Yeah, you're talking about essentially comic book characters because very few comic strips dealt with that thing.
Well, the Phantom did. I remember that.
Well, I don't think anybody really worried about who the secret identity of the Phantom was. He rarely appeared without his mask and his costume, and when he did, he was referred to as Mr. Walker, and he wore dark glasses and an overcoat pulled up around his neck, and if he took his hat and dark glasses off, there was the mask and the hood, the same old Phantom costume. But the comic book characters, the secret identity thing was became a convention, in fact, still is a convention in most comic books about superheroes. I think that the essential mechanism – I once wrote a long piece about the psychology of the secret identity and what that really was masking for all of us. But there's something that's quite simple that's happening, and that is that young people are among the most abused of humanity, and they always feel they're being put upon and taken advantage of by adults. And if the adults if they only had – a secret identity as an all-powerful superhero, they could get even with these oppressors. And I'm sure that that's the principal psychological mechanism that made them so attractive to young readers. One of the great ones, of course, was Captain Marvel, who put in an appearance when this teenage newsboy named Billy Batson shouted Shazam, and there was a bolt of lightning, and he was transformed into a muscular adult. And people have struggled for years trying to figure out whether Captain Marvel was a different being or he was just a physically improved Billy Batson.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes Captain Marvel behaved like a teenager. He was really he was very awkward around women, for example, or particularly good-looking women, and exactly as you would expect an adolescent to be. So that was always fascinating. And the big thing that always happened to Billy Batson was somebody figured out that they had to not only tie him up but gag him so that he yeah. couldn't escape. He was always being gagged, and he was figuring out ways to snag the gag on the cogwheel of a piece of dangerous machinery, and that would rip the gag off, and he would say Shazam, and whoop-de-doo, there he'd be.
Could I ask one last question?
Sure.
It's just the notion of writer's craft. If you buy a novel and you love a particular author, you read it either sitting down 2-3 days, you read it, or it might take you a month. But anyway, you're reading an enormous amount of information, and it kind of fills your psychic life. You think of it, you dream about it, perhaps you talk about it with people. And then you go to comics, and again, I remember this as a kid, not anymore, but being absolutely fascinated with these 2 or 3 frames of things that might not have more than 3 or 4 sentences in them, and yet the continuity of preoccupation was there from day to day to day, you know, month after month, year after year. Mm-hmm. And yet when you added the whole thing up, you might only end up after 2 years, you might only have 100 sentences.
Yeah, right.
Well, what's the trick there? How can
the trick is the pictures.
Well, yeah.
I mean, human beings have always been intrigued with pictures. We keep find caves with pictures drawn on the wall. The visual element, illustration, drawing, whatever it may be, has always held an attraction for people. And they'll look at pictures before they'll read words, I think. I suspect that that's what did it. You're quite right. I mean, if you were to take just add up or run all the sentences in the speech balloons in a year's comics, you wouldn't get a very long book out of it.
No.
But what's missing is the descriptions of scenes and the description of the characters' expressions and things of that nature, what they're wearing. All of those descriptive things are handled by the pictures. Uh-huh. So that's why the words don't take much room, but the pictures are serving another. Fulfilling another function.
Yeah. Well, fascinating. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Well, since we're here sort of on the subject of cartoon and comic superheroes, I am prompted to ask you about the death of Captain America. I'm not sure exactly when this happened. Fairly recently in they killed the character, and there was in popular media, there was lots of commentary about
yes,
it,
yeah.
what it meant, why they did it. Would Captain America come back? Is this just basically something to get a little bit of attention for the
yes.
strip and generate some buzz? Yes, you say yes. So then sometime later he can...
It's a little bit more than that. The incident, the death of Captain America, occurred during a complicated interrelated series of comic books from Marvel Comics that were all dealing with what they called the Civil War. And what they did was to imagine a circumstance in which, for reasons that I won't go into, the government, the United States government, said to the superheroes that populated the country, "You must register your secret identities or you will be outlaws." Well, some of the superheroes said, "This is an invasion of privacy. It is an encroachment on my rights as a human being." Others said, "It's my patriotic duty to do what the government tells me to do." Now, you can see the conflict that is established here. This is exactly the conflict that has been taking place in real life ever since the Patriot Act was passed in 2001. And the Marvel Comics people put it into their comic book. Captain America represented he was the champion of those superheroes who believed that their rights were being infringed upon by this government regulation, and he fought against it. Finally, he was persuaded to go along, and he went to the courthouse to, in effect, surrender his secret identity, and that's where he was killed. Now, if you're fond of analogies and metaphors, you can find in the death of America, of Captain America, the death of those things about America that many people value, namely personal liberty and privacy.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with author, cartoon historian Bob Harvey. He has a website, rcharvey.com, where he has posts about what's going on in the world of comic art. He's authored a number of books, including The Art of the Funnies and The Art of the Comic Book, and I'm sure you can find those at the bookstore. And the new one, which is a biography of Milt Caniff, the creator of Terry and the Pirates and Steve Canyon. This book has just been published. Fantagraphics Books is the publisher, and he will be doing a book signing at Pages for All Ages this weekend, Saturday at 2 in the afternoon, and we'll do a short talk beforehand. So if you'd like to meet him and like to pick up a copy of the book, like to hear more about Milt Caniff, you can stop by there. And, of course, here, questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things I thought was interesting in, about Caniff, and I don't know if other artists did this, he did use some live models to create characters and then also to work on the composition and posing of figures and so forth. Did other artists do that?
Anytime you see a picture, a photograph, Milton Caniff drawing from a live model, it is a circumstance that has been deliberately staged for the benefit of the photographer, whose picture will be published in the newspaper, giving publicity to Milton Caniff and whichever newspaper comic strip he
so
is presently
doing.
He actually
didn't really
he
do that.
He never did that. No.
Okay.
He almost never did that. I should say that. There were times when he was having difficulty deciding how the wrinkles in a particular garment would fall, and he'd ask his wife or his studio assistant to put on a trench coat and sit in a chair in front of him. But as a general rule, he drew from images in his head. He didn't draw from models. Many of the characters that he invented were based upon real people, but the real people were not models. They didn't appear before Caniff to be drawn. A lot of cartoonists who draw realistically do the same things that I've just described Caniff is doing. There's a new book coming out this fall, in, let's say, November. And it's a book about Alex Raymond, who drew Flash Gordon, Secret Agent X9, Jungle Jim, and Rip Kirby. And he was a stunningly beautiful illustrator, a master of black pen and ink. And he did the same thing Caniff did. If you see a picture of Alex Raymond drawing from a model, it's been staged for the purpose.
Okay.
But he also occasionally hired a model just to keep his hand in. So that, well, as one cartoonist said, you have to do some life drawing every once in a while, or you find yourself repeating the same cliches, visual cliches that you become accustomed to. So to throw yourself out of that, you should draw from a live model every once in a while. And Raymond did that. But many of Caniff's characters were based on real people. The most famous one during World War II was based on Philip Cochran, who was a fighter pilot during World War II, and Caniff based the character that he invented called Flip Corkin on Philip Cochran. And he didn't know at the beginning. He started to go and visit Cochran's training camp and watch how he was running other pilots through their drill and so forth, just to get a feel for what this was really like. And then he realized what a character Cochran was. I mean, Cochran was just he carried the records for his squadron in his back pocket, you know, and everybody called him Flip. So he was the character. Caniff had very little inventing to do. He just the character walked into the strip. Caniff frequently used characters in the movies who were popular as models, either for the personalities or sometimes for the physical appearance. One of his most unsavory characters was based on Charles Laughton, for example. He always said that the Dragon Lady, which was his most famous creation in Terry and the Pirates, was based on Joan Crawford. But I don't think so. In fact, I think that that was one of those things that he invented after the fact. I think his invention of the Dragon Lady was entirely independent from Joan Crawford. And then he saw her in a movie, and she was wearing a costume that he subsequently appropriated for the Dragon Lady to wear. And at that point, Joan Crawford became the model for the Dragon Lady. But I don't think she was originally. And there were numerous characters throughout the history of both Terry and the Pirates and Steve Canyon that were based on real people. And and sometimes actual people appeared in the strip. Bob Hope showed up one time, and he did a sequence one time with John Wayne, who was a fraternity brother of Kniff's, not in the same college, but they were in Sigma Chi together, appearing as a world as a Revolutionary War hero, Mad Anthony Wayne, a general, and he drew John Wayne as the character. He did it, he said, in order he thought John Wayne would get a kick out of seeing himself in the funnies, and Wayne was a big fan. Unfortunately, the sequence appeared just after Wayne died of cancer.
Something else that really strikes me about the strip is that there seems to be a lot of, wait a minute, okay, let me just bring you a little weather bulletin here just real quick. The National Weather Service in Lincoln has now issued a flash flood warning for southern Coles County in east central Illinois and for Cumberland County, also eastern Shelby County, and also southern Moultrie County in central Illinois. All this until 3:45 this afternoon. At 11:45, National Weather Service Doppler radar indicated flash flooding from a line of thunderstorms over the warned area and moving southeast along I-70. Doppler radar has estimated 1 to 2 inches of rain in the past hour from east of Shelbyville to Mattoon. This replaces the flash flood warning that was issued earlier on. So again, keep abreast of what's going on with the weather, and coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine 12:35, we will bring you the latest on the weather. I think Mike Sola will be doing the weather. What I was going to say is it strikes me there's a lot of sex in this strip, you know, to the extent that you could put it into a newspaper at the time. And it strikes me that that might be something that would set it apart. You know, there are other comic strips where there are families, there are married couples, they have children, but you can't quite imagine them doing anything to get those right, children. Yeah. But the people in Terry and the Pirates, they were pretty randy. By comparison, seemingly, I guess I just wonder whether anybody ever criticized the strip for being too racy.
Not Terry and the Pirates. During World War II, Kniff drew a comic strip for circulation among military unit newspapers. It was called Mail Call, and it was it came out once a week, and it was not about any Terry and the Pirates character. The central character, or the central figure, was a woman named Miss Lace, who always wore a very tight-fitting, strapless evening gown. She was, as Kniff said, the central figure because she had one. And this newspaper, this strip, was printed in over 3,000 newspapers at one time or another. They were all military papers, the greatest circulation of any newspaper, of any comic strip. But the sex was always hovering in the background of the Mail Call strip, and nothing blatant. You know, we'd look at it today; it's fairly tame stuff. But after he got out of the World War II was over, and Kniff gave up Terry and the Pirates and started Steve Canyon, he was persuaded somehow that because his readers would now include a lot of the ex-GIs who had read Mail Call, that he could get away in Steve Canyon with more sexual content than he had thought would be possible. The content in this case was just sexier drawings of some of his female characters. And after he had done a little bit of that, he started to get objection to it. And so he pulled back on it. But there were two characters in Terry and the Pirates, the Dragon Lady, and Burma was another one, who was based on the character Sadie Thompson in, Vaughn, Somerset Maugham's play Rain, I think it was, or the movie Rain. And people always thought that, or someone once described these two characters, the Dragon Lady and Burma, that you could imagine spending a night with Burma and that she would please your every fantasy. And if you spend a night with a Dragon Lady, she would please only herself.
Just real quick, I think one of the things that's really noteworthy about this guy, it does have to do with Steve Canyon, and that is the fact that that was his strip, and it was not the case. Very, very few artists own right. their work. They and their work are owned by the syndicates that employ them. And for him to have broken out after he said, I'm not going to do Terry and the Pirates anymore, he had the opportunity to create another strip and make some good money and essentially own the product, which was very yes. rare. Even, yeah. I guess, still now, that's very rare.
Well, it's today it is more customary. Many of the new cartoonists own their strip or they own something about the strip. The usual arrangement is that the copyright is owned by the syndicate, but it reverts to the cartoonist if he decides to leave the syndicate at the end of a contract period or if the strip is retired and he has other uses for it. One of the fascinating things about Kniff, if I have another minute, is not so much his function as a cartoonist, although being a cartoonist was his life. But he led a gifted – I mean his life sort of enacted the American dream. He worked hard. He had talent. He achieved great fame and great success. And his greatest fame was achieved in the name of patriotism during World War II. He continued in that same fashion, and when the Vietnam War came along, that very thing destroyed him. The patriotism that you could find in Steve Canyon was exactly the thing nobody wanted to read anything about during the Vietnam War. The strip lost circulation by the carload lot, and fortunately, Kniff lived long enough to see that feeling coming back, the patriotism coming back. By then, the circulation of the strip had been completely reduced. It went from 700 papers to 80 or something like that. But I've thought that the arc of Kniff's life is a fascinating, there's almost a Greek tragedy quality about it, because the very thing that made him famous is the thing that in the end destroyed him. Well, of course, it didn't destroy him, but it made a unhappier ending to a career than he might otherwise have had. Mm-hmm. He eventually realized that the audience for patriotism during the Vietnam War was not the same as it had been during World War II, and he changed some elements of his strip in order to recognize that.
We're going to have to leave it at that, but if you're interested in hearing more from our guest cartoon historian Bob Harvey, he will be doing a book signing this weekend at Pages for All Ages, Saturday afternoon at 2, and we'll be talking about Milt Kniff, the creator of Terry and the Pirates and Steve Canyon. He's authored a new biography of Kniff, and you can pick up a copy of the book or at least take a look at it this weekend. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. I enjoyed it.
Today's broadcast made possible by a grant from Trophy Time in Champaign, with plaques and promotional products to recognize all occasions from athletic endeavors to musical moments to business achievements. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies. Additional information available on the web, trophytime.com. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of Alice and Robert Campbell. That's it for us. Up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, our guest will be Eric J. Dolan. He is the author of Leviathan, the History of Whaling in America. Again, he'll join us following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look at commodity prices in Kansas City. September wheat, 5.96 and a quarter, up 2.5. December, 6.12, up 3. Now to Chicago. September wheat, 6.13, up 11 and a quarter. December, 6.29, up 11. September corn, 3.22 and a half, down 12 and a quarter. December, 3.36 and a half, down 12. March, 3.51, down 10 and three quarters. December 08, 3.85, down 6.5. August beans, 8.44 and a half, down 27 and a quarter. September, 8.54, down 27 and a quarter. November, 8.70.